you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast, coming to you today from the Asia Society of Switzerland here in Zurich. Let's hear what that famous Swiss enthusiasm sounds like. All right. The Seneca Podcast is a weekly discussion of current affairs in China and is produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day through our free email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, or at the website subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today on the Seneca Podcast, the good people at the Asia Society Switzerland have convened what I am sure will be a fascinating conversation about one of the most widely criticized and least well-understood policies to come out of Beijing in recent years, the social credit system. Is it a manifestation of Chinese techno-authoritarianism, a police state run amok? Is it a sinister and Orwellian system as the media has often portrayed? Is it just a pragmatic solution to a problem that bedevils this famously low trust society of contemporary China? Well, this evening we will try and shed some light on what the social credit system actually is, and just as importantly, what it is not. So we're delighted to be joined for the first time by Manya Kutsi, who created and runs the fantastic website whatsonweibo.com. If you haven't already started reading it, I really highly encourage you to do so. It focuses on what's trending on China's popular social media platforms like Weibo and WeChat or Weixin. It's an absolutely indispensable resource for anyone who is interested in gaining a better understanding of contemporary China. And Manya is simply one of the most astute observers of public opinion as lensed through social media out of China. In all of China watching land, there isn't really anyone who's doing quite what she's doing. So Manya, a very warm welcome to Seneca, and sorry that it's taken so long for me to finally get you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined again by Rogier Kremers, who had been on the show a couple of times before and is always one of my favorite guests. He's now a lecturer at the University of Leiden, where he's now been for a couple of years since finishing his postdoc work at Oxford. He's also a China Digital Economy Fellow at the New America Institute. Rogier has written extensively on the social credit system, in particular one great colossal paper of like 15,000 words in length or something like that. It's quite a tome. It's great. And he's forgotten more about it than I will ever know. He's a quite prolific translator of obscure, dense Chinese legal documents. It's work that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, but Rogier has taken it up with real gusto, and he's made invaluable contributions on the study of modern China. Plus, he's also a guitar player, so that's very much to his credit, too. Welcome back to Seneca, Rogier.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Manya and Rogier, let's jump right in, and if either of you want to add anything to what the other says, I don't know who wants to go first, but what are what is the problem, or what are the problems that the social credit system is intended to address? In maybe another way of putting this is, what is meant with sincerity in the proposed social credit system? Well, we start with you. Well, Rogier, you can go first. What do they want to do with this system?
Well, where it originally comes from, you see the term social credit appearing in the early 2000s, and there it's very much a response to the development of the market economy that brings problems with it, right? People cheat. People sell substandard goods. People don't pay their debts. People sell counterfeit goods, and so on and so forth. And it really started out in the market economy, that idea that you should simply do what is expected of you in a normal market economic environment. Over the past couple of years, that notion has broadened somewhat to also include things like benefit fraud, but also official abuse.
So it's meant to address the problem of a low trust environment in China, essentially.
Exactly. There is another problem as well, which is slightly more focused and connects slightly also to the Sesame Credit initiative that we'll be talking about. But that's very much the credit angle of it, where the Chinese financial system has historically dealt very badly with individuals. And so part of what some angles of the social credit system are about building up a consumer financial infrastructure.
Because unlike the United States, where we have things like Equifax, where we have credit rating agents, or I guess we call them credit scoring bureaus, there's nothing like that in China at present. Is that right?
Well, now there is, but there wasn't back then. And one problem with China is also that until very, very recently, China was largely a cash economy. So you didn't really even have records of people's financial history. So if you're going to lend to them, what are you going to base that decision on?
Right. Very good point. Mania, how has this been discussed in the official media? Before we get into public opinion on this, how has the social credit system been sold to the Chinese public, and what's the messaging been all about?
It's not really been sold as a system per se, although the word in Chinese also has the word system, but it's more about creating a culture of trust. So it's actually being brought as a culture or an idea more than a system per se. And in state media, you see different things. You see some really dry reports on people having meetings. And I would recommend everybody reading it, but maybe just before bedtime. and then what you see in state media is a lot of cartoons, which has I think that was really interesting to see the different type of cartoons that were used with these articles. And these were mostly about, first, bringing harmony to the people by the social credit system, and then punishing the people who need to be punished. So it's both a rewarding system and a very punitive system. And that's quite straightforward in these cartoons that you see in state media.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm very suspicious anytime I see some initiative being promoted through cartoon-based propaganda. But let's leave that aside for now. That's interesting that they don't seem to be sort of selling it on its direct merits. Just sort of this vague promise of bringing harmony and maybe putting a floor. But surely, when they talk about punishing the ne'er-do-wells, the people who are delinquent and stuff like that, there's reason for us to be suspicious that this is part of a broader sort of surveillance, a way to nudge behaviors in a desired direction. And, that sounds very intrusive. Is that not something that Chinese people seem so concerned about?
I'm now talking, maybe Rogier can answer from another perspective, but just looking at social media, what people are saying about this, actually I found over the past year that people have been very positive about this, because finally now there's a way to punish all those people that, are misbehaving on trains, are smoking a cigarette in the middle of a hospital, are, recently some stories that went trending of people refusing to get up from their window seat, which they didn't even have a ticket for on the train. And now they're like, okay, finally they can be blacklisted and they deserve not to take the train for the coming 180 days.
You wrote an interesting piece. I mean, we'll talk about the difference between the official credit system that's being planned for the year 2020 and Sesame Credit, and how these two are often conflated. But speaking specifically about Sesame Credit, which is rolled out by Alibaba, the gigantic e-commerce giant in China, you wrote a piece about how it's not just the desire to see these wrongdoers punished, but also their positive benefits that people seem to believe that they can have by participating, by opting in to Sesame Credit. What are those? How would you describe why people would want this in their lives?
Yeah. So this is such a contrast between day and night. If you look at, I'm talking about Western media, of course, I know it's a little bit of a dangerous term sometimes, but mainstream American or European media saying all these citizens are having their score and this is dystopia. And then I look at Weibo and what my friends in China are saying. They're like, oh yes, finally my credit score is 650. Now I can rent a bike without having to pay a deposit. Recently, some hospitals hospitals in China are experimenting with people who have a good credit score, that they can skip lines, they can have rent wheelchairs for free. But also there are more commercial activities like you can try out the new Ford car for 3 days, test drive it for free if you have a high credit score. There are many, many examples, but really nice perks, really nice things that you can benefit from.
People use it on their online dating accounts as well.
Oh, really? You can advertise your social, your Sesame credit score on online dating. I mean, it sounds to me like a little bit like how excited I get when I'm about to hit, you know, platinum status on my mileage card for an airline. Is that a fair analogy?
Well, in very many ways, the Sesame credit system is actually, it's a combination of a user trust system on an e-commerce platform that presents itself as a trusted intermediary and a loyalty scheme. So yes, that's an absolutely right comparison.
Yeah, very, very different, as you say. I suppose some people would hear this and suggest that there are pretty fundamental differences between the political culture that would inform, say, a state that would come up with such a scheme in the first place. I mean, talking about the official system, and a Western public that hears news about this and, you know, it recoils in horror, reacts very negatively to it, you know, and generally assumes the worst of it. Is that what we've seen playing out here? Totally different culturally conditioned norms about, you know, the relationship, the right relationship between state and society. Is that how you would describe what's happening here, in the difference in the response?
Well, certainly one thing that I should point to is I think the Chinese state, since pretty much the last two millennia, has had a much bigger claim to moral authority. In Chinese history, you've never quite had something like a separate organized church that sort of parallels the Catholic Church, that sort of could take responsibility for, you know, what is the good life? How should people behave over the bare minimum standard of lawfulness? And so that idea of the state has been inherited to a significant degree by the Chinese Communist Party, which also adds on the socialist sort of notion of the malleable human being, right? Social engineering. And so you are in a system where, at least within the logic of that system, it is not illegitimate for the state to not just want people to obey the law, but for people to live virtuously. And I think we find that a bit scary.
Mania, what do you think?
What I think is that the perspective, looking at this social credit system, social media, I'm always talking about social media, is that the lens is so political that we forget that there are more ways to look at this system than just political. I mean, it's political, like Rogier already mentioned, there are many economic dimensions to it, there are cultural dimensions to it, and I feel that we've somehow been trapped in this one-dimensional vision of this system or this policy, just looking at it from that angle politically, and also from the idea that it's the state versus the people. Right. Always the state versus the people, like the rat, the Tom and Jerry, the cat catching the rat. And it's much more multidimensional than that. So we should be careful not to, you know, only look at it through one certain lens.
I think the meta problem is the following. I'm a China scholar. I move in academia. And the dominant question that has shaped contemporary China studies over the last 2-3 decades is, how the hell is this place still around?
Right.
Right? You're supposed to have disappeared into the dustbin of history together with the USSR and all these other socialist regimes. And so we start out with that by seeing the existence of the People's Republic in China today as a fundamental aberration. That in itself is already wrong, and therefore everything that emanates from it must be wrong as well.
Yeah, that's a bold statement. I was mentioning earlier that in the United States we have these credit scoring organizations, Equifax, I think one of them is called TransUnion, Experian. I think these are the three biggest ones. And they have a shocking amount of data about us. I mean, I check my credit score fairly religiously, maybe the same way, because, you know, it allows me then, if I know I'm going to try to take out a loan on a new vehicle, or I want to do some repairs to my house and I want to take out a bank loan, that's going to be the number that decides. And they have records of things, and they're quite explicit about it, about, your debt burden, the size of your debt burden, about your repayment history on everything from, you know, electrical utilities to, you know, finances on your loan. They know how much money you actually make. They have quite a bit of information. My colleague, Jeremy Goldcorn, in an earlier podcast, had pointed out how I can go online and find out who he can go online and find out exactly how much I paid for my house. That seems rather intrusive to a lot of people. In fact, I think you can't do that in China. You wouldn't be able to get that information. So is there why are the Americans especially so vexed by this idea of a Chinese social credit system when they themselves seem so willingly to expose so much of their personal information?
The Equifax story goes, in fact, even further when you take a look at their history. Until the first consumer credit protection regulations came in the 1970s, Equifax would just profile people on the basis of race, gender, the quality of their marriage as told to them by their neighbors. If you were homosexual, you know, they'd know. And
do that count for you or against you?
Well, America of the 1960s, you tell me. But the point is, Western societies, and I think America is even an outlier at that point. The foundational narrative of America is lawful resistance against overbearing government power. That's the essential story of the U.S. And therefore, the U.S. has a very thick layer of political thought and discourse and commonly held beliefs about abuse of public power, next to zero about private power. China, I would almost say, goes quite the opposite way. Europe, a little bit in the middle.
Interesting. Well, speaking of Europe, I mean, here we are in Europe, in a continent where concerns over data privacy are certainly far in excess of what they are, say, in the United States. I don't read European languages well. Both of you do. Both of you are fluent in several of them. And I don't have a good sense of how social credit has been covered outside of the English language press. So can you tell me, Manu, what are European papers saying about the social credit system? Are they largely in line with what the American press is writing?
I think more or less, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I do get quite some calls from journalists asking me about it. I also, of course, I'm Dutch and I follow the media in the Netherlands. But what it seems like, there's a lot of clickbait articles. I also understand that a lot of media are under pressure, you know, to get more readers. But what I feel is that there's one publication, this already started in 2015 with some American publications, putting out this story, grossly conflating all these things of the commercial credit systems with the scores that go until 850, I believe, 350 to 850. Conflating these commercial system with the government system. And actually, if I read all that, I would be really scared too. That's sure. A grim story. But the thing is, there's no fact checking. So if all these sources all the time trace back to these stories from 2015, 16, and even this week, if everybody's repeating the same scary stories, you know, that's lazy journalism, and it's also a little bit dangerous. But also, I understand why it's scary. If you don't do the fact checking, the story that they bring is scary, right?
Right, absolutely.
And frankly, the fact checking is really difficult. That paper that I wrote that Kaiser mentioned in the intro, it took me 2.5 years to write.
Well, 2.5 years ago in 2015, though, you had actually published some translations of the foundational documents that laid out the ideas of the social credit system. And it was actually based largely on that translation, on your writing, that this story sort of had legs in the first place. They cited it quite widely. And, you know, you and there were only a handful of other peoples who had actually waded through these actual regulatory documents. Well, first of all, where can we find, if we, our Chinese isn't up to it, maybe where could we find those English translations?
So there's a couple of good places. I've got some documents on my old website, which is called China Copyright and Media. Just Google it and you'll find it there. But the biggest collection of social credit documents is on chinalawtranslate.com, which is a website run by Jeremy Daum. And Jeremy's actually really gone into the nitty-gritty of some of the ministerial credit systems and some of the local stuff as well.
Would I be right in saying that I remember we had this conversation, when you first started seeing the reports that were being written and citing you, you were frankly pretty horrified by what they had done with the work that you had written, and you were trying to correct people here and there, right?
Yeah, and this is the problem with, you know, when you're an academic and you're broaching like something that looks promising. I got to the social credit system because I was doing some preliminary research on data policy, big data policy by the Chinese government. And you come across this document and you go, this looks interesting. I'll translate it, throw it online, had a couple of conversations with journalists. But the problem is the 2014 plan, which is sort of like the big foundational document that everyone refers back to. It's a bit like Foucault. Everyone cites it without reading it. And certainly a lot of people who cite it, even if they've read it, they haven't necessarily understood it very well or understood its logic or its context. And that's a problem, right? You stumble onto something and you need to figure out what it is. And you have to do that in a Chinese context where this is a plan. At that point in time, there were local trials going on, but you need to dig them out. You need to read through the materials. You need to read through the policy history. And in the meantime, you know, the popular press, which isn't under the pressure of peer review, sort of, you know, picks it up and picks up a couple of snippets and runs with it. And so what you get is sort of like you get a few snippets from a Chinese government document filtered through the Fu Manchu filter of a mainstream media who, let's be honest, whose professional etiquette sort of seems to comprise that, you know, China is not our friend.
What did you first feel when you saw that? I mean,
what did I feel?
No, sorry. I want to know about your feelings too, but
mine aren't important.
No, I was like, you know, this is an interesting thing. It's potentially a big thing. I'm going to need some time to sort of make sense of this. This was also sort of, I was very much in a big data mindset at that point in time. And one of my discoveries later is that until the present day, the government social credit system is not big data based at all. Huh. There is no big data analysis in the government social credit system. There is, in fact, at the central level, no quantitative scoring in the government social credit.
What about in the local initiatives?
And this is where it gets difficult because, so, like I said, social credit as a term sort of emerges in the early 2000s. You have an interministerial joint committee that's formed to sort of start experimenting with sort of this stuff in 2007. But what always happens in China is you have local mayors who pick up some of the stuff, think that this might be useful in my city, or if I do this well, I might get promoted. And so you start trials even before the central trials happening in many places, big cities like Hangzhou, smaller cities as well. And so it's very difficult to say, you know, this is the approach. We're just now getting to that stage. But you have some localities that will say, you know, all governmental social credit systems are based on infringements of existing laws and regulations. You have to see it as an amplification device for the enforcement of existing laws and regulations. And some local governments have said, look, we're going to give you a score. And if you break these and these and these regulations, it's going to cost you X number of points. And if you start out as a sort of standard citizen, and you can drop down. And if you drop down, that is going to cost you access to subsidies or access to government jobs, for instance. Those are some of the examples. There's been some research done on Rongcheng, a small city in Shandong, who does it. And they essentially found out that over 90% of local residents are A, which is sort of what you are when you haven't done anything really wrong, but also when you haven't done anything really right in terms of, you know, volunteer service, blood donating, and so on and so forth.
Oh, so there are behaviors that will actually boost your score through, like, donating blood.
If you live in Rongcheng, yes.
Okay, all right. which raises the question of how much uniformity, how much consistency is there among all these different local pilot initiatives? Are they scoring on the same criteria? Are they using the same scale? Are they punishing in similar ways? What is there any uniformity among these initiatives?
There is family resemblance in terms of the fact that, you know, the things that you're going to be punished for, which, you know, if a local government is punishing you, it has to be for things that are within the jurisdiction of a local government. So that will be things like traffic, sort of violations of local regulations and so on and so forth. And so the things that they will be punishing are generally similar. Obviously, the things that governments can take away from you are vaguely similar. But I wouldn't say that there is a sort of harmonized, uniform approach. About a good year and a half ago, the central government anointed 10 model cities mm-hmm. who are sort of to be taken as examples of how to do it. But these are also very different cities in terms of their economic level of development. Hangzhou is one, and obviously Hangzhou is sort of a major urban metropolis close to Shanghai. There's a couple of rural places as well, and obviously approaches are going to vary.
Well, the fact that Hangzhou is also home, the headquarters of Alibaba, which is the biggest sort of private initiative that we're all aware of, the Sesame Credit, that probably has helped this conflation. We're going to move into a discussion of some of the things that the press is getting wrong, other than what we've already pointed out. But before we do that, I want to draw attention to a piece that, Mania, you just published yesterday on What's on Weibo, which was absolutely fascinating. What you had done, if I'm just maybe can sum it up, is you looked at attitudes expressed about it on foreign social media sites, especially on Twitter, versus on Chinese social media sites like Weibo and on Weixin. You looked at the conversations in a sort of quantitative way, at the frequency of mentions, the intensity of sentiment, the direction of sentiment that people had. And you did kind of word clouds. So you looked at the kind of language that was used in China versus in the Western media to describe these systems. And the results were startlingly different. Can you elaborate on what these differences were?
Yes. Well, first, what I do with What's on Weibo, of course, is I track trending topics. And this was a little bit difficult for me with the social credit system because, you know, I get called about it and it's all the time. I see it everywhere on Twitter, but it's not a trending topic on Weibo. So I was looking on Weibo, looking at what to write about, where do I find my angle? And then that is my angle. My angle is the fact that it is trending. I see it on Facebook. I see it on Twitter. I see it everywhere on Google News. And then I do not see it on Weibo. So
is that just due to internet censorship, though?
I don't think so. One of the reasons, there are some websites like Free Weibo, for example, sure. .com, who track the bigger topics that are being censored. Social credit system definitely is not one of them. And then another thing is that state media is actually trying to propagate articles that are about the system, and various local social credit systems are on Weibo. So if anything, I have the feeling that probably there are people out there who wish there was more talked about on Weibo instead of less. So I don't have a feeling that it's being censored at all. So then what I did is I started looking at the different media discourses in the West and in China, and just picked out random articles that ranked pretty high on Baidu News or on Google News, three typical ones from Western media, three typical ones from English language Chinese state media, and compare the words that pop up. And perhaps unsurprisingly, what you see in Western media, of course, is a lot of words like the score, the credit, the government, punishment, citizens, surveillance, and then on the Chinese
Orwellian,
side...
Orwellian, did you get that one?
No, they only use it once, so it was not enough to...
What about Black Mirror?
Sorry, yes, very good. Black Mirror is one of the biggest words. Thanks for reminding me.
Does everyone know what Black Mirror is? How many of you have seen this Netflix show, Black Mirror?
Many people. It's
a terrific show. I mean, I really quite enjoy it. It's about, you know, the way that our technologies, our everyday technologies, projected into a pretty near-term future can go horribly, horribly wrong. And there are often... What's the name of that episode from series
one? Nosedive.
Nosedive. There's one in particular about a system that looks suspiciously like a social credit system where everyone is constantly rating everyone else. It's, you know, like you rate your Uber driver or your Uber driver rates you, but this becomes the basis on which you are given social access to things. You can't get into the right parties if you're a three. If you're a five, you're whisked right into the party or whatever. And it's about a woman who... has a bad day, has a few bad interactions, and she takes a nosedive, and basically her credit score gets worse and worse. So that's often being compared to, right?
Well, you can see from Google Trends, you have a lot of websites where you can find these insights. You see that if people Twitter about the China social credit system, the other thing that's most Twittered about is Black Mirror, and the same is with Google search results. If you people search most for both Black Mirror and China's social credit system. So that's such a different story, because if you look at Chinese state media, the words that pop up when they talk talk about China's social credit system is more things more like harmony, unifying, building together, enjoying together, blacklist, red list. So it's the vocabulary is startling difference.
And,
really.
And Black Mirror is very popular in China too. It showed on a number of the popular Chinese video sites. It's called Heijing. That word didn't show up, I guess.
But it's a sci-fi. Yeah, no.
Right. That's fascinating. So you mentioned blacklists as one of the words that showed up. But we hear a lot about these blacklists. We've read a number of stories about people who were denied access to high-speed rail transportation or trains. And in a lot of the reporting that we've seen is this implicit idea that the blacklists are an integral part of the nascent social credit system. Is that true?
It is, in fact, the only really functioning part of the social credit system as it is today. The idea behind the blacklist system is really simple. If you have done something wrong, over and above the sort of the normal punishment, you get put on a blacklist if you meet certain conditions. And if you are on that blacklist, then there are certain things that you can't do. Now, there are by now dozens of blacklists at the central level alone. And some of them are really specialized. So there's a blacklist for workplace safety infringements. But there's also blacklists for people who misbehave on trains or on airplanes. And, you know, we've all enjoyed the haha series of stories, you know, emerging from China. First time flyer wants a bit of fresh air, opens emergency exit sort of thing. Right. That's what this is aimed at. The first and broadest and most authoritative blacklist is run by the Supreme People's Court. And that's
Supreme
the judgment
Court, right.
at the Supreme People's Court. And that's the judgment defaulter blacklist. And there the principle is very simple. If you have been convicted of a specific offense, and there's a list, a very long list of offenses falling under that, and you haven't met the terms of your conviction, you haven't paid your fine, you haven't paid the compensation, you haven't met whatever, you know, judicial order was meted out against you, then you end up on that blacklist. And if you are on that blacklist, you know, you can't become a senior corporate official. You might find it more difficult to get a loan, but also because this blacklist is very much targeted at debt defaulters, right? The idea is, if you don't have money to pay your debts, if you don't have money to pay your fines, you don't have money for luxurious consumption. So you're not flying. You're not traveling first class on high-speed railways. You are not staying in luxury hotels. You can still travel, but you'll be traveling heart seat in Chuggy Chuggington that stops at every station, and you will be spending the night in 12 to a room travelers inns. You know that's how it works. There is by now a system that recognizes people who are on multiple blacklists, and that sort of gets you a special gold star blacklist status. And the idea is that these blacklists are public. So apart from the fact that you have the sanctions that attach to being on the blacklist, there's a sort of naming and shaming aspect involved. And that's very important, because what we often forget is the social credit system isn't just aimed at individuals. It's also aimed against businesses. And so if you're going to be doing business with someone, if you're going to go to a restaurant or you're going to buy expensive stuff from somewhere, you know, the idea is you can check whether or not they're fraudulent.
Hmm. Mania, you wrote an interesting piece about a university student or somebody who was trying to gain admission to a university and was denied precisely because his father or both his parents, I can't remember, were on such a blacklist. That story got a lot of play in China. Can you talk about that and give us a recap of what happened?
Yeah, that was actually one of the few stories that I've seen this year on Chinese social media that actually became trending in relation to blacklists or the social credit system. And that happened, I believe it was in July. And this was a young man who had scored really high in his Gaokao, the national university entrance exams, which is really hard to get a high score. So everybody understands that. And then he was denied entrance because his father was on a blacklist for being in debt, and he had failed for the past 2 years to repay a local bank a debt of about $30,000. So yeah, this is, but Jeremy Dom from ChinaLawTranslate.com later, rightfully so, clarified this article saying that it was a private university. It couldn't have been a public university because they're not allowed to deny children of parents who are on a blacklist, but private
can.
Private universities can.
And did you bear that out? It was a private university?
It was. And actually, Jeremy also was able to track down this Mr. Rao, was his name. So he's so good in his research always, right?
Yeah,
he actually
meticulous.
Tracked down the guy on the actual blacklist saying, you know, this is really not a fake news story. Everything is there. So it just shows how the system is. But this story got, within one day, about 30,000 comments on Weibo, with many people saying it's just unfair for children to be punished by the behavior of their parents. And this is quite a controversial aspect of this blacklisting system. And it reminds me, actually, earlier this year, that is actually not to do with the social credit system itself, but in Guangdong, there was an experiment with people who had used drugs. Their front doors were being put on with graffiti saying, here, a drug using family lives here, even if it was just one person who had used drugs. And that also got a lot of controversy, and many people were upset about that as well. And it reminded me of that.
It should have just marked the kid's bedroom door, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, this is quite controversial.
But if I can just chip in, this does show something very important, right? This social credit system isn't just rammed down the throats of the Chinese citizen. There is space for debate. In fact, one of the local trials run in a place called Suining, close to Shanghai in Jiangsu province, was actually shut down after it was criticized quite harshly in national official media. So, there is some jostling for, you know, we want the system on the whole, but there, as with any system, there are going to be negative consequences. And not to want to present the Chinese government as more benevolent than it is, or indeed more intelligent than it is, but it is also too simplistic to say that this is just top-down imposed, no questions asked.
Rohir, while we've got you here, what about the tendency to conflate this with other systems of surveillance? We read an awful lot about how facial recognition, you know, this AI technology, is being deployed not just in law enforcement purposes, although that may already have sort of sinister dimensions to it in our thinking, but also in things as quotidian as not letting people get more toilet paper than they need at a public restroom. I mean, you've all maybe seen these stories. What about this? Is there a relationship between this extensive system of camera surveillance, biometrics, and whatnot, and the so-called and then the social credit system as we understand it?
It's a question that's a little bit difficult to answer because there is no single one social credit system.
Right.
There are hundreds of social credit systems that together sort of make up a social credit ecosystem, if that's what you want to call it, and they have a similar logic. So yes, there are in some cities. There are facial recognition cameras that recognize people jaywalking. And if they do it too often, remember, the social credit system is an amplification device for existing laws and regulations. It was not lawful to walk through a red traffic light 10 years ago. It's not lawful today. What this changes is the ability to detect that. That being said, when you look at the institutional environment in which the social credit system is built, it's built around the National Development and Reform Commission and the attached ministries and the People's Bank of China, where the financial system is concerned.
The courts too, right?
And the courts with the Supreme Court. The police is a little bit sort of on the outer. It's involved in a couple of things, but it's very much not in the center of that. So when we are talking about sort of hard law enforcement or some of the stuff that's going on in Xinjiang, that's simply in a different bit of the Chinese state. And yes, similar technologies will be used. But to say that it's all one big thing, I think, again, overestimates the level of integration between the different initiatives that the Chinese government is deploying.
So I live in the United States, and I have been in the last year or so watching with mounting horror the rapid descent, the downward spiral of the U.S.-China relationship, And it's become quite obvious to me that this isn't about just trade issues. It's certainly not about steel overcapacity in aluminum or agriculture or I think low-end manufactured goods. It's very much about technology. It's the United States' anxiety over China's industrial policy, and specifically this Made in China 2025 program that wants to propel China to the forefront in the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution, especially in manufacturing advanced robotics and artificial intelligence and what have you. I can't help but think that there is a relationship between this concern in the policy realm and the kind of coverage that we're seeing, the kind of interest that we're seeing now in these sort of techno-authoritarian news items, everything from, you know, the facial recognition for the toilet paper rolls to things like this social credit system and what have you. And there's a lot more than that. You know, you've got that Bloomberg piece that came out right before Mike Pence made his now infamous speech that basically declared an end to engagement with China. This piece that claimed that motherboards that were being manufactured had a green rice side microchip on them that was providing a backdoor to the Chinese government, presumably, and that these were installed widely in the servers owned by Apple and by Amazon. There's been a lot of controversy over whether there's any merit to this claim. But then there were other stories about how President Trump is using an unsecured iPhone that is being tapped by Russia and, of course, now by China. Lots of these stories that all focus on technology and cast China as this some sort of, you know, techno-authoritarian villain and a mastermind. So, I mean, it's hard for me not to see this kind of horrified fascination that the American media has with a social credit system as really part of this same, not entirely false narrative of China as a rising technology power. What do you guys make of this? Do you agree that this is part of a kind of new zeitgeist?
I think that's a very interesting meta issue. I grew up during the wonderfully boring and naive, in comparison, sort of 1990s post-Cold War, where we thought we had the world figured out, we being the West. We thought we knew how things were supposed to go, right? Free market economics, open international trade, globalization, liberal democracy, human rights, that was it. And the world outside of North America, Europe, where, you know, these things weren't yet installed, they were sure to follow. And in very many ways, digital technology was the poster child of that particular way of thinking, right? The internet was going to open borders, allow us all to communicate, make us free, end authoritarianism, and so on and so forth. And over the last couple of years, we've come to the conclusion that we were very, very badly mistaken in that view. That, you know, at the meta level, not only, as I said earlier, has China defied our expectations that it would either democratize or stagnate or, you know, have socialism disappear into the dustbin of history, it's thriving. And so with regard to China, we believe that this cannot be possible in a right world. So they must have cheated. That's one. Two, our own societies aren't doing very great either. I mean, the United States is not a happy place right now. Britain isn't a happy place right now. Many countries in Europe aren't happy places right now. But rather than self-reflect on this and sort of figure out our problems, it's a lot easier to simply say, you know, it's the Chinese what done it.
that's good.
And
the Chinese what done it? Is that what you said?
Yep. And the third level again comes back to technology. It's that we're now getting scared of technology, right? We've gone from this illusion that everything that emerged out of Silicon Valley was sort of, you know, unicorns peeing rainbows, sort of thing, to wait a minute, my iPhone knows everything. Tech companies are not paying their tax, which is very much a European complaint. Or they sort of vacuum away all of our data and sell it to
Cambridge Analytica,
you know, or our friends in Russia. So
same thing.
So the point is, when then a story like social credit comes up, it almost becomes therapeutic to scratch mm-hmm. that itch. In other words,
so you're saying this is...
It's about us.
It's about us and not about China.
Yeah, we are not really interested in what is happening in China. Otherwise, you know, more people would read my 15,000 word paper.
That's funny.
I've read it.
You know, if you're ever suffering from insomnia, it's a free download and a guaranteed cure. But so the point is, if we were actually interested in China, we'd want to get it right, even within the limitations of this is a complex thing. There's not very many of us studying this. It's not about that. It's about scratching an itch.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'd like to add to that that one of the best read stories on Watson Weibo ever was of a little robot getting out of control a few years ago at the Shanghai Tech Conference. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do.
His name was Little Chubby, and he completely went out of control and he hospitalized someone. And I wrote about that, and BuzzFeed immediately jumped on it, and everybody was like, yeah, you see, the Chinese robots are getting out of control. It's like...
It's the beginning of the uprising. Skynet is... right. That's hysterical. I mean, we talked earlier about maybe the different cultural norms that have affected attitudes toward the uses and abuses of technology by authoritarian states. What about broader attitudes toward technology in society? Earlier today, we were doing a panel and somebody quoted me saying, you know, that China is in its Star Trek phase while we've moved into our Black Mirror phase. And I think that's probably quite true to some extent. Maybe, Mani, you've got your finger on the pulse like no one else. So what are attitudes about technology like among ordinary, you know, Chinese internet users? Are they afraid of it?
Oh, no. No, definitely not. What I notice is people are enthusiastic because life is getting so much more convenient.
Right.
And now, especially in urban China, I mean, technology is affecting the daily lives of people to such an extreme extent. I have friends in China who in the morning when they get up from bed, they order a cup of coffee and within 10 minutes, so they do it by Meituan. Or Waimai or what is it called? And within 10 minutes, there will be somebody knocking on the door with a warm cup of coffee. Then they take a Didi, the Chinese Uber, the whole day. WeChat plays an enormous role. They get automatically clocked into their work with the Ding Ding app, also by Alibaba. And then they order food at night. And I mean, the whole day is focused around technology. So it's making life easier. It's making life more fun. So you don't see these dystopian discussions as much in China. Or actually, I never really hear them at all or read about them.
Right. I think that's very interesting that, here in the West, our leading technologists and our leading scientists, the technologists like Elon Musk, I've talked about this before on this show, or even Bill Gates talk frequently about summoning the demon, about the about AI is going to pose an existential threat to our society. Stephen Hawking, the late physicist, same thing. He talked about it a lot. You don't hear that conversation not only in the high echelons of Chinese science, but it's really relegated to the bowels of philosophy departments in obscure universities mainly. And you certainly don't hear it talked about in ordinary day-to-day life. That, I think, is really telling and says a lot about why this observation you've made about the different conversations about social credit are happening in the West and in China. That's really a fascinating thing.
If I may add one Absolutely. Thing to that, I think this also, not only the social credit system, but also the digitalization of China in general. One of the biggest trends right now is the sharing economy. China is right now the biggest sharing economy in the world. With 2 years ago in Beijing, you would not see any sharing bikes, and that now there's 2 million. I mean, sometimes you cannot even walk on the
there's a song about that
sidewalks.
Oh yeah.
Well,
yeah,
there's much more than 16 million, or what was it? 5 million. Sorry. But sharing economy and that, so that is something that's really sustainable. I mean, people share umbrellas, people share bikes, people share cars, sleep cabins, karaoke rooms.
Sex dolls.
Oh, my God.
But anyway. It didn't work.
That makes
Shared
life,
sex dolls is a bad idea.
That's a very bad idea. Basketballs, okay, but yeah. But anyway, it makes...
What do you do with your basketballs?
It's more environmentally friendly. It makes life better. It makes people more mobile. So for many people, this is also, it's such a good development.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, as I was saying earlier today, the improvement of your tangible life has happened in lockstep over the course of the last 30 years or so with the improvement of the device that you've got. I mean, it's there's no reason for Chinese people to be as suspicious, perhaps.
There are sort of two other elements to that which I think are important. And one is that the gains in sort of quality of life, if that's what you want to call it, that you can make through digitization in China are simply much bigger, right?
How's that? How do you explain that?
So when you look at digital payment here, in China by now, you know, you will have beggars that have a Alipay QR code in their begging bowl. So you can pay through them electronically, and they have a smartphone on which they can receive it. Here, things like Apple Pay, Belgium is getting Apple Pay next year. But the reason for that is that we have credit cards, debit cards, and that's a system that works quite well for, you know, in terms of digital payment. Whereas China goes in one step from being a completely cash-based economy where, you know, people were lugging around piles of 100 yuan notes to do major purchases, and where you had to have cash with you in order to buy anything. Where mobile payment just makes that a lot easier. And that's true, I think, across a swathe of, you know, daily activities. The second is, and this is particularly coming from a European, you know, we're used to a lot smaller cities, but large Chinese cities are tough to navigate. And so making life more convenient, you know, when you live in a city like Zurich here or Leiden, like I do, you have your neighborhood supermarket. It's around the corner. You can walk there in 3 minutes. Try walking anywhere in 3 minutes in Beijing.
Right. These enormous sort of inhumanly scaled cities with ridiculously broad streets and this, kind of crushing, almost brutalist architecture everywhere. Yeah. You know, there is so much more to talk about with this topic, and I would love to spend more time on it, but I'm afraid our time here is limited. So let's move on now to recommendations, that segment of our show. First, let me remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by Sup China. Sign up for our free email newsletter, and I mean this, sign up for our free email newsletter. Do it. It's just so good. You know, everything that I know about China comes through our newsletter now, and it's amazing. Or better yet, subscribe to our premium access service. You get additional newsletters. You get bonus content like this podcast. You get it ad-free. Not this ad. Keep this ad in. Ad-free and early. You know, you'll get it on Monday rather than on Thursday. And meanwhile, check out our growing roster of podcasts in the Seneca Network. These include now the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, Tech Buzz China, which if you're interested in technology topics, you absolutely have to listen to it, with the lovely hosts Ray Ma and Yingying Lu. We have the New Voices podcast on women in the culture space in China. And then, of course, our newest member, the China Econ Talk podcast with Jordan Schneider. By the time that we launch this, we will have launched, this show airs, you'll have hopefully heard our newest member, which is called Ta for Ta. It's another women-focused podcast about women at the top of their game in the world of Chinese business. So please check those out. Now, on to recommendations. Manya, why don't you go first? What do you have for our listeners this week?
What I would like to recommend, well, there's so much to choose from, but one thing that I would like to mention is the platform monk.hu, Manchu. It's by Fresco Samson, so that's monk.hu.
M-A-N-C.hu.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And why I admire him is because he's bringing out a very dusty topic in a way, where many people are still interested in, though, the Manchu language and culture. And he added it added a technological layer to it. So through online, you can study that and learn more about Manchu.
Wow, that's
yeah, it's
that's
a very
great.
Cool project. So check it out. Yeah,
there. I have met a couple of Manchu speakers in my life. It's a great. I would highly recommend you go on YouTube and you search for people actually speaking the Manchu language. It's fascinating to listen to. It's like nothing you've ever heard before, and I suspect that it may be part of where the Beijing dialect came from, because there's a lot of that kind of gargling pirate going on in there. Okay, Rohir, what do you have for us? That's a great recommendation. Thanks. manc.hu.
Well, Kaiser has very graciously given me permission to plug a new project that I'm involved in as a co-founder. It's called DigiChina. It's an online knowledge platform that we're working with New America, with support of Leiden University's Leiden Asia Center. And the idea is that we provide information on the development of China's digital economy and digital politics. So now it's blog posts and translations. But the future objective is to essentially build a full wiki on institutions, companies, personalities, a lexicon on how certain terms should be interpreted and not as we get more resources in the future. So we hope you find that a useful resource. But my real recommendation is a book that I'm reading at the moment by Oxford history professor Peter Frankopan. It's called The Silk Roads. And it's
plural S, right?
Yes,
roads, right.
Plural S. That's good. And every chapter is like the road of faith, the road to Concord, and so on and so forth. Ah. It's a wonderful history of the landmass, essentially starting in Constantinople and ending in Beijing, and everything that happens in the middle. Looks at the rise and fall of empires, the spread of faiths, the interrelationship of trade, politics, beliefs. I'm around halfway through it, and I can't wait to get back to the hotel room to continue reading. It's a wonderful book.
For me, as a dedicated medalist, anything that involves horseback, pastoral nomads slaughtering, sedentary agrarian peoples is rocking. I love it. That's good. So yeah, that'll be fun. I love Central Asian history a lot. And to your other point about your new initiative, the Digital China thing, I am somebody who firmly believes that if you want to count yourself among people who understand China, it's maybe too broad, but if you want to be counted among a respectable China watcher, you really need to know something about the digital landscape in China. You need to know who these players are, who the whole sort of cast of characters, the dramatis personae of the internet company founders and the new startups and the venture capital people and the thinkers in that space. You need to know sort of the ins and outs of the arguments that are happening on the Chinese internet. So read Manya's excellent site for that. And about the internet in China, you need to know the regulatory environment. I mean, because this really is the crucible of contemporary Chinese culture. I mean, you cannot understand China without really getting a good grasp of the internet. It's that crazy meme machine of the internet. And if you don't get it, you're toast. So that's great. My recommendation, in addition to my hearty endorsement of all the aforementioned, is a book that I'm reading right now as I was on the plane on the way over here. It's called The Black Count. It's called Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and the Real Count of Monte Cristo, which is, I neglected to write down the name of the author right now, and I can't remember his name. It's a really kind of banal name, but you look it up, The Black Count. And it's about the father of the novelist Alexandre Dumas, who wrote, of course, The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo. And it's a remarkable story. This book won the Pulitzer, or the National Book Award, the Pulitzer for biography a few years ago. And it's a really well-constructed biography of this man who was born to a disgraced French nobleman and a Haitian slave, an African slave. He grew up in the salons of Paris on the eve of the French Revolution, became a soldier, enlisted as a common private, rose through the ranks and became general, did all this as a black man in and slightly post-revolutionary France. So it's really, really fascinating. And you can see where all the touchstones were that Dumas drew on for his books, both The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo, if you're a fan of that. So I've had a delightful time reading this book. You'll enjoy it too, I'm sure. So with that, special thanks. Of course, I want to make a special thanks to Nico Luxinger and to his colleagues, Serena and Anna especially, for all of the hospitality that they've shown to the three of us. And thank you, of course, to the Asia Society of Switzerland for inviting us and being so generous. And with that, gute Nacht, Zurich.